Random House Audio presents Bird's Eye, The Adventures of a Curious Man by Mark Kurlansky. Read for you by John Van Ness. To be perfectly honest, I am best described as just a guy with a very large bump of curiosity and a gambling instinct. Clarence Birdseye, The American Magazine, February 1951. Curiosity is one of the permanent and certain characteristics of a vigorous intellect. Samuel Johnson, The Rambler, March 12, 1751. Preface. I never met Clarence Birdseye, who died shortly before I turned 8 years old in 1956. I never met any of his 7 siblings, nor his wife Eleanor. I met only one of his 4 children, the eldest, Kellogg, whom I interviewed when researching my book about cod. His grandchildren were all very young when Birdseye died, and know little of him. I did interview 2 surviving sisters-in-law and numerous people who had known him. The work of a biographer often seems to resemble that of a detective, chasing down clues. Birdseye left a scattered and incomplete record. There is no autobiography or memoir. Surprisingly, the only book Birdseye has left us is a small volume on gardening, which was mostly written by his wife. Huge help was provided by one of the grandsons, Henry, who had more than 20 unopened boxes, which, once he was easily persuaded to open them, revealed a few treasures, including numerous letters from Labrador and Peru. Another grandson, Michael, had a few pieces of the puzzle, such as a collection of his patents and some lost magazine articles. Kellogg, the son, had 8 leather-bound handwritten journals from Birdseye's time in Labrador, which Kellogg's widow, Gypsy, donated to Amherst College. They show a great deal about his quirks and interests as well as activities, but were not laid out in a way to give a later historian a clear picture of events. Birdseye's colleagues and collaborators wrote about him. Birdseye wrote numerous articles about himself and his ideas. But the subject himself is not always an infallible source either, especially a man like Birdseye, who had an image of himself that he wanted to promote, a very American image of a lot of audacity, not much intellect, and a pioneer spirit. The first and last of these were largely true, the second manifestly not. There are many brief articles on the life of Clarence Birdseye, some written in his lifetime, some at the time of his death, some later. Most of these articles say the exact same things, some true and some not, often with incorrect dates. Unfortunately, these articles appear to have been the source for more articles, and so often the errors are repeated. There are at least 40 encyclopedias and dictionaries that contain entries on Clarence Birdseye ranging from general to business to inventors to food. But these 2 are full of errors and conflicting information. When I decided to write this book, I had already written about Birdseye in 3 of my books, The History of Cod, The History of Salt, and The History of Gloucester. It was time to separate myth from truth and find out who this man with the funny name who changed our way of life really was. Undeniably, Birdseye changed our civilization. He created an industry by modernizing the process of food preservation, and in so doing, nationalized and then internationalized food distribution. Birdseye was among the first to talk about that internationalization. In a speech at Montreal's McGill University in 1943, he predicted the post-war world when he announced, "Tomorrow the industry will become truly international." And he was right. This facilitated urban living and helped to take people away from the farms, so that by the early years of the 21st century, for the first time in human history, the majority of people on Earth lived in an urban area. This would have been no surprise to Birdseye, who often spoke of how improved food preservation made urban life possible. For many people, a major issue is the internationalization of food distribution. Birdseye greatly contributed to the development of industrial-scale agriculture. He even worked with farmers to make their products more suitable for industry. But unlike people today who have grown distrustful of big business, For Birdseye, a product of the zenith of the Industrial Revolution, industry was always a good word, without negative connotations. Today's locavore movement, the movement to shun food from afar and eat what is produced locally, would have perplexed him. Why, Birdseye would have wondered, would you want to be limited by local production when the food of the world is available? What would he have thought to see that in his hometown of Brooklyn and his adopted home of Gloucester, there are open-air markets selling local produce when consumers could go to a supermarket and buy the food of California, France, and China for less money? It would have made little sense to Birdseye to prefer small artisanal farms with low and inconsistent yields to the miracles of agribusiness. Birdseye loved food, loved to cook, and wrote, thought, and talked about eating much more than most people. He was what would be called today a foodie, but he was a 19th century foodie, a foodie in reverse, who ate wild local food and artisanally made products, the food of family farms, but who dreamed of making food industrial. It can, and probably always will be debated, whether this is a good thing. The real argument is whether, in changing our eating habits, Birdseye made life better. He personally had no doubt that what he was doing was improving life, but that is largely because he considered his frozen food to be fresh. The idea still exists in the odd commercial oxymoron, fresh frozen. An increasing number of people today ask what this phrase means. How can it be fresh if it is frozen? The claim is that it was preserved in a fresh state. When Birdseye was developing fast freezing, the product seemed remarkably fresh when compared with the existing preserved foods, slow frozen, canned, salted, or smoked. My grandfather was a tailor, and he handmade all my father's clothes. And so my father grew up dreaming of someday owning a factory-made suit. We are all more reactive against the condition we inherit than we realize. In the post-industrial world, we have become anti-industry, and it is useful and fascinating to get to know a man of vision and imagination who genuinely believed in industrial answers to life's problems. To understand Birdseye in the context of his times, we need to grasp that people who are accustomed only to artisanal goods long for the industrial. It is only when the usual product is industrial that the artisanal is longed for. That is why artisanal food, the dream of the food of family farms, caught on so powerfully in California, one of the early strongholds of agribusiness with little tradition of small family farms. Birdseye came from a world that was becoming rapidly industrialized, and yet one in which food production was lagging behind and still mostly artisanal. Birdseye was a naturalist, fascinated by every mammal, reptile, insect, and plant he ran across. But he was not an environmentalist and did not think about the effects of urbanization, industry, and agribusiness on habitat. He was interested in increasing the catches of fishermen, not in the issue of overfishing, a concept that seems never to have occurred to him. It seems certain that were he alive today, he would see things very differently and would turn his inventive mind to solving today's problems. Birdseye was a man who kept up with new developments and always wanted to know the latest. Solving problems was his primary interest. He was a rare and original man who lived in the forefront of his times, operating through imaginative thinking, skilled hands, and great daring. He was a wonder then, and he would be a wonder today. Prologue. A Curious End. The lobster boats made in Deer Isle, Maine, in the 1940s and 1950s were cumbersome vessels with rounded wooden hulls that made them roll in the slightest swell. Even on a flat sea, they were hard to direct, and a steady course could only be achieved by spinning the wheel far to the starboard, then, when the bow started to shift, spinning it back far to port. If it was done right, the result could be a straight line, but this was not easy to accomplish. Heading into the wind was impossible, so the boat had to be steered at angles like a tacking sailboat. In 1956, Sarah Robbins had just bought such a boat and kept it by her home in the old fishing port of Gloucester, Massachusetts. She had not in the least mastered the stubby 35-foot craft when she...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?